welcome to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Philip Drew, Administrator. A quote here from Thomas Jefferson I found last night. Quote, "The two enemies of the people are criminals and government. So let us tie the second down with the chains of the Constitution so the second will not become the legalized version of the first." And now, I'm sure you've heard the chains of the Constitution quote, and you know, they didn't have TV back then, and so the founders tended to use their choice sound bites over and over again, and so this was a new context that I found the chains of the Constitution quote in there, and I like that. Keep the national government chained by the Constitution so it does not just become a bunch of legalized criminals. Well, our guest today is Chuck Michaels. He's the author of the book No Greater Threat, America After September 11th and the Rise of the National Security State. He's an attorney from Baltimore, Maryland, a former radio host, TV host, newspaper reporter, editor, and columnist. He's the co-founder of Pax Christi, a national peace group, and is a member of the Catholic Labor Committee. And the new book, No Greater Threat, America After September 11th and the Rise of the National Security State. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thanks, Philip.
I guess I should ask you why you decided to start writing this book, or I don't know, that's not a very good first question. What was it that made you decide to write a book about the Patriot Act?
Well, no, it is a very good first question, and I think that one of the things that got me most interested in it was starting to, as I was tracking these issues, come across a lot of email and letters and announcements from a variety of advocacy and civil liberties groups about the Patriot Act as it was going through Congress and what a danger it would be if it was passed. And of course there wasn't at that time a clear indication of how lopsided the vote would be, because it was quite substantial once the act was passed through Congress. And once that happened, there was even a greater amount of concern, and so I decided once that whole statute was available in the law library to actually go and read it cover to cover. And once I did that, I was just amazed by its complexity and its scope and its breadth, and also was struck by the fact that most of what had been complained about it only relates to a small portion of the statute. So I started thinking maybe it would be good to perhaps see if we could get the word out about the entire statute, and I started writing from that point.
And in your book, you go through all 10 sections of the Patriot Act, one by one.
Right, all 10 titles, that's right.
Is there any way we can get you to do a brief version of that for us here?
Well, the statute is really quite a lot of material. The titles basically relate to various areas of federal law that the Patriot Act amends in its whole process. There is significant change in the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and how that works. There are changes in electronic surveillance and monitoring powers of the government. There are changes in how the government can obtain information and the secrecy that would be surrounding the process of getting that information. There are major changes in sentencing laws. There's a new crime of domestic terrorism. There are new additions to how the State Department or other government agencies can designate terrorist groups. There is an entire new section called International Money Laundering Abatement and Anti-Terrorist Financing Act of 2001. It's really basically Title III of the Patriot Act, a very long title that rewrites federal banking law. There are changes in immigration law. There's a changes in the DNA data bank. There are changes in information sharing requirements between the FBI and CIA, and it just goes on.
My goodness, you don't sound like you're very happy about any of those changes.
Well, I don't think most people should be, because I'm not sure if the Patriot Act was really necessary to solve whatever problems there may have been in investigative surveillance and law enforcement authorities with respect to September 11th, assuming you even believe that September 11th happened because these people dropped the ball, which I'm not, you know, it wasn't their fault. The people responsible for September 11th, unfortunately, are all dead. So I think unless, you know, there are some indications that we may have captured the mastermind behind September 11th or whatnot, but the real folks who carried out the act are no longer available to be brought to justice. Whether that act was the result of an intelligence failure I think it's a very narrow way of looking at the entire problem of terrorism.
Well, and we found out, really, since September 11th that there were plenty of FBI agents who were trying very hard to investigate these guys and who, under the current law, had all the power that they needed, but their bosses just wouldn't let them go to the judges for a warrant.
Well, that, there is one suggestion that the investigation of Massawi, who's now on trial, could have been sped up, and maybe the plot, someone might have stumbled onto the plot if a warrant would have been issued for getting into his computer, or there are a variety of complaints that have been made by the FBI on that. But that's simply a question of whether there was enough probable cause to sustain that particular warrant. That doesn't necessitate all of what we've got now with the Patriot Act. And a lot of what I think was revealed, speaking of that, in the Joint House Senate Intelligence Committee report on the supposed intelligence failures or law enforcement deficiencies of September 11th, is a lot of prioritizing, tasking, analysis, awareness, chain of command, cooperation, activity, quickness, the sort of things that sometimes can get bogged down in law enforcement circles. And
well, and the kinds of things that changing the law doesn't change any of those circumstances.
That's right, because then we have the Office of Inspector General report on what happened to the September 11th detainees, and that very point was raised again. Inertia and problems and lack of communication between the Bureau of Prisons and the FBI and the CIA and so on and so on and local government. So it is a continual problem. So I'm not sure if the Patriot Act is really that necessary to provide those additional authorities.
I read an article, I think, a week or two ago, and I searched like mad this morning for it on the Internet, and I could not find it anywhere. But I read an article that said that the Patriot Act's real purpose was to bring us up to standard into compliance with international financial law. You mentioned that Section 3 there was all the new financial
title
crime. Title 3, yeah. I wonder, can you explain, is that correct, that the Patriot Act was made to bring us into compliance with international law?
Well, I'm not enough of a banking lawyer to answer that. I'd have to take a look at the article and find out what the article was talking about. I imagine that there could be some difficulties for international terrorist threat investigative agencies trying to look into U.S. banking records to try and discover terrorist financing and money laundering, and maybe Title III is assisting with that. I don't know. I don't think it's quite the sort of thing that the article would suggest, because Title III has a potential sunset provision in it. So if it was necessary to bring us into compliance with international law, and that's the last thing that the United States has ever been concerned about, I kind of doubt that if the entire title could possibly be done away with in 2005.
Okay, well, I tried so hard to find that article this morning so I could refer you to it by name, but I could not find it. I read it only a week or two ago. It's out there somewhere. Mm-hmm. But anyway, another part of that Title III is bringing back up the Know Your Customer regulations that the American people and our Congress mm-hmm. rejected 2 years ago or 3 years ago,
mm-hmm.
right?
Well, it's more or less the banking lobby rejected it, but that's a very good point. You're one of the few people who even were aware of the Know Your Customer regulations that the Clinton administration had proposed. So you go to the head of the class when it comes to financial money laundering and banking investigation authorities. Yeah, the Know Your Customer regulations, as I understand them, and I've never seen them, was an attempt by the federal government to get banks to more closely track and monitor individuals who open accounts and transact business through accounts, and to identify certain accounts that might be possibly suspect and so forth. And the banks felt that it would be administratively burdensome and an impediment to banking business, and effectively had those proposed regulations withdrawn. And now we have a Know Your Customer program that is at least five times more extreme than what was originally proposed.
Five times more extreme?
Well, the Know Your Customer was going to be a regulation process that would get banks to conduct that kind of monitoring and keep records and so on. But now we have extended jurisdiction of federal courts into money laundering. We have new money laundering authorities. And under Title III, federal investigators can impose what's called a special measures order on a on a bank or domestic financial institution to obtain information about suspected money laundering or financial transaction activity. There are new international levels of cooperation involved now. There are new forfeiture provisions that don't affect the banks necessarily, but certainly would affect people who are potentially suspects in material support for terrorism or money laundering that would be involved in terrorism. And a lot of this isn't necessarily even restricted to terrorist crimes. It could be involving any crime. So now we're also into drug investigations, and in fact, a fair amount of this kind of activity so far had been drug investigations and maybe racketeering and organized crime, that sort of thing. So we have a much greater level of involvement in the Treasury Department or potential involvement in banking activity and banking affairs. And we have a new bureau of the Treasury Department called FinCEN, which is the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network that's established by Title III of the Patriot Act. And that's going to be a new information hub to track and monitor financial transactions of all sorts. It's just a new day for the banking industry.
Didn't FinCEN already exist before the Patriot Act?
Not to the extent that it exists today. The new authorities that were granted to it by Title III and new funding and appropriations levels, I think, have greatly increased that office.
Okay, now another part of the Patriot Act that you brought up was the information sharing, and I have a specific question on that, but I suppose first I'd like you to just kind of give kind of a basic outline of what was changed in the information sharing between the different executive agencies.
Well, I'm sure information sharing already occurred, of course, to a great degree, but there are a couple of changes that the Patriot Act makes. A lot of the information sharing has to do with foreign intelligence, and there's a fair amount of amendments to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act that relate to this, but it also could involve other levels of information. But if it has to do with terrorism or foreign intelligence or terrorism investigations, information sharing can now occur directly from one federal official to another. There's a whole list of federal agencies that could be included in this information sharing loop, including law enforcement agencies, domestic intelligence agencies, foreign intelligence agencies, protective immigration, a variety of others, and of course the Department of Homeland Security is now among those agencies that all can be part of this information sharing process. So one of the changes is that the information sharing process is greatly expanded. Another change is that a lot of it is now mandated. There are information sharing requirements between the Department of Justice, FBI, and a variety of other agencies, including the CIA, and vice versa. And then another requirement, and this is an expansion of the kind of information that can be shared, grand jury testimony, for example, other kinds of information that are obtained from all these other investigations that we were talking about, foreign intelligence information that's obtained through the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, investigative authorities. So what you have is kind of a threefold process of information sharing that is not only more extensive and broader, but also more clearly mandated in federal law.
Right. So, actually, this is one of the things about the libraries, isn't it, that in order to search the library, they can now go to the FISA court, which has a much lower standard of evidence than probable cause that they would need from a regular judge, right?
That's potentially true, and a large part of that is Section 215, which is in Title II of the Patriot Act. Thus allows the FBI access to, quote, any tangible thing, unquote. Now, there is no specific mention of bookstores or libraries in the Patriot Act, but there has been, I think, a fair amount of concern that has developed among those kinds of advocacy groups, lobby groups on behalf of librarians and bookstores and ACLU and so on, about how under that section the FBI potentially could go to a library and bookstore and get patron information or customer information, the kind of books an individual has checked out, or what kind of books the person has purchased, that sort of thing.
And imprison the librarian if she comes forward and says, hey, the FBI was here digging through the files today, right?
I'm sorry, what did you hear?
They can imprison the librarian if she comes
forward. Well, I don't know if she'd go to jail, but, I mean, it possibly could be considered, it would be a violation of the statute, which is supposed to make those investigations secret, yes.
Okay, now here's my most important question, or, well, to me anyway. I've interviewed Tim Lynch from the Cato Institute. He's their House expert on the Patriot Act. And I was actually just re-listening to that interview the other day, listening to it again, I should say. And there was one unresolved point that it was totally my fault. I just didn't phrase the question right, and he didn't quite get a hold of what I was trying to ask him. So I want to paint this scenario for you, and you tell me if this is right or wrong. Say, for example, the NSA is tapping phones all across the land, and they accidentally come across a drug deal or a financial crime or a murder. Hey, help me move the body from here to there or something like that. Can they, the national security, the intelligence agencies, can they turn over information about domestic crimes like that that don't have a connection to terrorism necessarily, but it's something that they accidentally overheard in the course of their intelligence investigations? Can they go ahead and turn that over to the FBI now?
I would say that it's possible. If the NSA is doing that, then it may potentially be illegal if the NSA didn't have a congressional finding, or rather a presidential finding, or any other legal basis to be tapping someone's phone. And NSA ordinarily wouldn't do that. They're usually intercepting international calls and so on. But if that happens and there's reasonable basis to believe that a crime had been committed or maybe is in the process of being committed or a conspiracy to commit a crime or conceal evidence is underway, then I suppose the NSA could turn that information over to the FBI. Now, whether the FBI could ever use that information as admissible evidence is another question that still might give the FBI probable cause to believe that that individual needs to be the subject of independent level of surveillance, and you may have to get a search warrant that would allow, or a wiretap order that would allow further investigation or surveillance on a legal basis. If there is, and in fact the Patriot Act even provides for this, let's say, taking something that's a little more likely, an internet service provider that's routinely monitoring emails comes across an email from a person that says, okay, well, we're gonna, you know, bomb the federal building in such and such a town on such and such a date, and there is reasonable cause to believe that that wasn't a joke, then the internet service provider is absolutely authorized to provide that information to law enforcement investigators if there is a potential for immediate threat or loss of human life.
Okay, but as far as the national government's intelligence apparatus being really used against the American people, that's not there yet.
I think that's there. Now, that's a separate question. Now, that now you're talking about, let's say, the FBI's Carnivore program, which has been renamed, the use of additional criminal information database programs such as RISNet and the NCIC, the use of whatever government data is being collected on individuals for putting together this new CAPS system that's going to be in place for pre-screening review of passengers who are going to be boarding domestic airlines. There is potential no-fly lists that are already being developed that have people on the terrorist watch list on them, but somehow or another there are some other individuals who have been involved in certain peace activities who are also winding up on that list. So, yeah, there are, I'd say, and there's the revelations in Denver, for example, of police files that have been kept on people, including activists. There is even suggestion in some places like California and New York that the new level of police surveillance of activist groups is continuing, sort of like what the Red Squads were back in the 40s and 50s, but I'd say much more sophisticated than that. So I think you do have a new level of, and there's the new FBI guidelines on counterterrorist operations that allow for a greater level of that kind of surveillance. So you have, I think, a new level of potential, if not actual, use of the government intelligence network domestically.
Does your book detail the Department of Homeland Security, or did you write all this before that passed?
I wrote it before that. We're working on a possible update to the book that would include a review of the Homeland Security Act and the Department of Homeland Security and what's in that statute. Yeah.
Excellent. Okay, now I noticed on your website you said that despite popular belief, that most parts of the Patriot Act, the most important ones at least, do not sunset.
That's true. There are only two sunset provisions in the Patriot Act. Title II has automatic sunset provisions for some aspects of the Patriot Act that are supposed to happen in the end of December 2005. That does not take care of all of Title II, but a fair number of the sections that have been causing concern. I don't think Section 215 that we were just talking about is in that, however. I think that does not sunset at all. And then there's also the sunset provision that we've already mentioned about Title III, which is all of this money laundering and banking provisions. And there is a potential to inactivate that entire title in 2005 also, on or about October 1st. But Congress would have to pass a joint resolution in order to do that. There are no other express sunset provisions anywhere else in the statute.
And I remember reading that Orrin Hatch and was it Arlen Specter were trying to take out the sunsets that were already in there. Was that successful?
Right. Orrin Hatch, and I'm not sure if Specter was involved, but I wouldn't be surprised because he has the same approach to the supposed importance of the Patriot Act. But yeah, there was already some activity in the Senate to repeal the sunset provisions of Title II, so that Title II would just be maintained indefinitely.
But that didn't work so far, right?
That was not passed. Okay. I'm not sure if it got out of committee, in fact.
Well, I hope not. Let's see, I found here the Department of Justice, this is from the October 8th San Francisco Chronicle, the Department of Justice admits taking advantage of the act to investigate, wiretap, surveil, and confiscate millions of dollars from U.S. citizens. They're using it for financial crimes, drugs, computer hackers, cash smugglers, I love that, child pornographers, and more.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's right.
Apparently this doesn't really have too much to do with terrorism at all.
Exactly, and that's one of the things that needs to be pointed out, is that much of the statute is not specifically directed to aliens or immigrants or terrorist cell groups or sleepers or lone wolves or anything like that. It's very broadly written. It involves investigations to all kinds of different potential criminal activities, especially Title III, which are these financial provisions we've been talking about. So, yes, that's true.
What exactly is a cash smuggler? Someone who has lots of cash and the government wants to steal it from them at gunpoint?
Well, that well-versed in bulk cash smuggling requirements or crimes, but there is a restriction as to how much cash of any particular, national currency or denomination you can bring into the country. And for some reason or another, I guess people want to bring in a lot of cash and briefcases and whatnot without declaring it or in violation of those provisions. You have to declare how much money you're bringing in. There's a limit to how much money you can bring in a certain time and so on. Bulk cash smuggling restrictions and requirements were, I think, also enhanced or tightened under the Patriot Act. So I imagine that there are people who are still doing that. But I can't speak in any detail about that.
And there were stories for years before the Patriot Act of people who, I remember seeing something on 2020 or something, maybe 10 years ago, about a housekeeper who had just saved up all her money in cash because she didn't trust banks, and she was on her way home to Venezuela or somewhere to bring all the money to her family. That's why she'd been saving it up. And they just stole it from her at the airport. Now the burden is on her to hire a lawyer and try to sue them to get her money back. But
yeah, I would imagine so, and that was a pretty silly thing to try and do.
Yeah, well, I mean, she wasn't a very sophisticated lady in the way that things work, but she knew that she had earned the money, and it was her money, and she was bringing it to her family, and they just stole it from her. And this is years and years before the Patriot Act ever existed. They were
Right, because they were both bulk cash smuggling or bulk cash restrictions that existed even before that. I think that at one time the limit was $10,000.
Which, depending on how rich you are, $10,000 may or may not be all that much money. I mean,
right.
To me, $10,000 is a king's ransom, but to a millionaire, $10,000 is spending money for a shopping trip to
right.
the islands or something, you know?
Right. That's right.
Yeah. Okay, well, now in your book you break down 12 common characteristics of a national security state.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if we could... last half hour here, if we can go through the 12 characteristics and maybe measure how America is measuring up to these characteristics right now.
Okay. Okay.
So what's number one?
Okay.
I'm sorry, I'll give you a minute to turn to that page in your book if you want to.
Yeah.
I didn't mean to catch you off guard there.
I'm just got to get to it.
Well, I found it on the web. I'll go ahead and tell you. Number one is a visible...
Number one is visible increase in uniformed security personnel. Number two, and I'll just read them what they are. Number two is lack of civil accountability of law enforcement and security personnel. Number three is reduced role of the judiciary and executive treatment of suspects. Number four is secrecy of the ruling authority and momentum of the threat. Number five is called media in the service of the state. Number six is public and national resources called into service against the security threat. Number seven is patriotism moving to nationalism. Number eight is lack of response by religious denominations, which I don't think necessarily is where we're at, but it would be on the list. Number nine is wartime mentality and permanent war economy. And number 10 is targeted individuals or groups. Number 11 is direct attack against dissent. And number 12 is increased surveillance of the citizenry. Now, it's my belief that, you know, we're seeing activity in all of those 12 items. Whether we've gotten to the point where all of them have gotten so fulfilled that we have actually arrived at a national security state. That's part of a different discussion, and it's the kind of debate I think Americans need to be having right now as we move into, you know, maybe what is the next wave of legislation and court review and administrative activity and military actions and military tribunals, for example. Those sorts of things are all going to be coming to pass over the next, I'd say, at least 6 to 9 months. So I would say, in terms of number one, visible increase in security personnel, I think that's obviously the case. Lack of civil accountability of law enforcement and security personnel, that's number two. I think that had, to a large degree, also been true in terms of what law enforcement officers have, shall we say, gotten away with, and with respect to how they have treated individuals or their conduct of detainees or arrestees or their street activities. Very few of those ever get to trial or are ever criminally prosecuted, and very few of them ever result in successful civil lawsuits. I think you're going to be seeing more of that kind of trend.
Well, yeah, and you could say that we've been like that for quite some time with sovereign immunity and so forth.
Right. And, well, there is a certain exception of sovereign immunity in certain federal and state statutes, but the question is whether you ever get to a jury on any of those things. Number three, reduce the role of the judiciary and executive treatment of suspects. I think we're really moving along with respect to that. And with the military tribunals happening and two decisions from federal appeals courts that have basically said that the courts have got no jurisdiction to even inquire into what's going on in military tribunals. So I think you're going to see a lot happening in executive treatment of suspects. And, of course, we have enemy combatants that have been declared above three people within the United States, too, are American citizens, and they're still being held under military authority with the courts not doing anything to strike that down.
Well, and I'll just stop you there before we move on to number four here. The reduced role of the judiciary, you mentioned those judges saying that they don't even have the jurisdiction to question or to file writ habeas corpus or anything like that for the Americans in naval custody now. But there's nothing even in the law that I asked Tim Lynch from Cato. He explained that the detention in military custody of these guys comes straight from executive order. It's just assumed under the commander-in-chief clause and the war powers of the president that he can do this. And so I wonder, is the Supreme Court going to be any more likely to hear this case than the lower two?
If the Supreme Court hears it, I think the decision from the Supreme Court is likely to be the same as the decision of those federal courts. And there are some Supreme Court authorities that in the past that have affirmed the use of military tribunals. I think there are, to my mind, some very important legal differences, such as the fact that we have no declaration of war by Congress and no congressional authorization of use of military tribunals. And I think that Congress still, even under separation of powers in the Constitution, could issue some sort of guidelines as to how these military tribunals are going to be conducted. But that's not even happening. So the whole thing is going on almost entirely through the Defense Department, Department of Justice, mostly the Defense Department, which recently issued guidelines as to how these tribunals are going to be conducted. And on top of that, there is no judicial review of a tribunal decision. So that's clearly executive treatment of suspects.
So we're really way outside the rule of law here with this.
I would say the rule of law is we are at the outer boundary of what the rule of law could be when we talk about the use of these military tribunals and whether even they're constitutional, since the executive order to establish them came without any kind of congressional declaration of war. I believe that this is the only time in American history where military tribunals have been used this extensively without a declaration of war taking place.
Yeah, well, I wish I could say it's the first time we've gone to war without a declaration of war, but
right.
It's 1941 at this point. Oh, my God. Okay, number four, the secrecy of the ruling authority and the momentum of the threat.
Right. And I think you see a lot of that happening now, where ruling authority and the secrecy that's surrounding, let's say, the enemy combatant status, the military tribunals we just talked about, some of those hearings might be closed. Immigration hearings that are potentially being closed, a decision from the Federal Court of Appeals in, I believe, New York, Second or Third Circuit, either New York or Philadelphia, maybe Philadelphia, had ruled that immigration hearings could be closed if the government so declared it. So that's another level of secrecy. We have an exemption from the Freedom of Information Act for a lot of information that is part of the Department of Homeland Security. We have new levels of secrecy surrounding these information gathering authorities and information sharing authorities that we were just talking about in the Patriot Act. And there's just, I think, an entire wave of new attempts to bring a lot of this government activity away from public information and scrutiny. So I think that secrecy of the ruling authority is very clear. Momentum of the threat is I think, beyond discussion. We continue to see announcements of this or that attack that's about to happen. I was working on the update that we may be doing for this book and trying to go through the press clippings that I had put together of every time the government has said there's going to be an attack somewhere, like a mall or a school or a bridge or a nuclear power plant or whatever. It's happening on a consistent basis. And then you have this threat level board that we're under now from the Department of Homeland Security that keeps raising or changing the threat level from yellow to red, or from yellow to orange, that is, we haven't been to red yet, from yellow to orange, or from yellow downwards, or continuing to maintain what it is that the threat level is. If you go to, you were talking about websites, if you go to the White House website or the Department of Defense website or the Department of Justice websites having to do with counterterrorism or Patriot Act issues, you get a lot of information about what the threat level is at the current time. Department of Homeland Security website does the same thing. So we're I think, absolutely in a momentum of the threat situation.
Okay, now before we move on to number five, I should have asked you this in the first place, but it's I think, especially appropriate before number five. When you came up with these 12 parts of characteristics of a national security state, where in history were you looking to find your definition? Is this, you looked at Germany and Russia and Cambodia and...
I'm looking at a variety of places. I mean, there are several examples of potential national security states that you could look at. There is even the United States in the World War II and immediately post-war periods, the 1940s and 50s, where a lot of these characteristics, I think, could apply. Certainly Russia, maybe Israel, maybe Germany in the 30s and 40s, certainly China, Burma, some of the other very closed sort of governmental systems. There are a couple of African nations that could be declared or considered national security states. South Africa during the apartheid regime may have some of these characteristics. So there's a whole variety of places, some Central American nations, especially those that were under junta rule or military rule in the 70s and 80s. Argentina during that period of time could be considered a national security state in some respects. So there's a variety of examples throughout 20th century history of situations that would fulfill these characteristics.
Okay, so you didn't just write down 12 characteristics that remind you of the Patriot Act and then go and try to find national security states that match it. You got these criteria from these other national security states, and now you're applying them to us.
Right.
Okay, I just want to make sure the order of the logic here, because I can see how, you know, you could write down 12 things you don't like about the Patriot Act and then try to make them rhyme with the way it was in Russia or Germany or whatever. So I just want to make sure which direction you started from with these.
No, I started from other historical precedents and historical antecedents of this, yeah. Because some of these things are cultural trends that don't necessarily have anything to do with the Patriot Act. Patriotism moving to nationalism, for example, media in the service of the state, those sorts of things. Direct attack against dissent often is a cultural trend as well as a governmental activity. So some of these things are not dependent upon the Patriot Act.
There's been a lot of propaganda on TV about how the media is so anti-war, and they only say bad things about the war, and even George Bush himself complaining about all the bad propaganda about Iraq, when actually everything over there is going so well. And, you know, I guess you got to be way off the charts like myself to think, wow, really? The administration is criticizing the media for being anti? Because here I thought that the media was just the mouthpiece for the state.
And I think the problem that we're seeing is that there is not enough of the kind of criticism that we need from the media and the critical thinking and the review of government analysis and rationales for government action that we really expect from and need from our media, especially national broadcast media. I think much more needs to be done to provide other points of view besides just whether you can consider it anti-war or liberal or what have you. There needs to be a much more serious approach toward taking a hard look at government action and whether any of what we've been talking about for this almost past hour or so has anything to do with solving the problem of terrorism or fighting the war on terrorism, or whether we're seeing enough successes, if you want to see it that way, to make any of this worthwhile, or the long-term threats to our constitutional system of government, or the problems of checks and balances that we're seeing as the courts sort of fade from the scene and reviewing government activity from the look of court decisions so far that seems to be occurring. All of that, I think, needs to be much more upfront in our media, and trying to make sure that these issues remain a matter of public concern as we move into the 2004 presidential election. I don't think we see an awful lot of that going on in our media.
Yeah, it's funny. If you look on the internet and all the self-published criticism and different alternative media around, you'd almost think you're living in a different country than the one that you see if you're watching television. They're just two entirely different things. On TV, we found weapons of mass destruction. The whole world was on our side, and everything is turning out hunky-dory. Didn't you hear the school just opened in downtown Baghdad? And then you go to the internet, and three troops die on average every day, and two more lose arms and legs, and the average Iraqi hates us where he used to like us, and it's like two entirely different worlds.
Right, and there needs to be much more of that other point of view in our national broadcast media, because the unfortunate thing is 95% of people who even use the internet usually use it for, you know, reviewing their homepage, emailing, and online shopping. So there's only a certain percentage of individuals, and even that is a fraction of the folks who watch television, especially national broadcast news, who are using the internet for this other level of information. So I think we're, in terms of number five on the list, that is a very serious concern, especially as media becomes more concentrated and information sources on a national broadcast basis become more collectivized. I think we're going to see a certain amount of sameness in that kind of information that should be a subject of great concern to Americans, especially when you consider that many of those media conglomerates also own print media and radio.
Especially when you consider that. You know, I'm going to skip number 6 here real quick. We can come back to it if you want, but I think 7 ties into 5 real well. The patriotism becomes nationalism. I would like to ask you exactly what do you mean by that, and how do you see the media's role in that?
Well, as I say, even though I'm an activist, there are certain aspects in which I don't really have a big problem, although I have, you know, I keep talking about how we don't really have nation states anymore, but still in all, there is this kind of what I would call sort of 4th of July, backyard hot dogs kind of traditional level of patriotism about, you know, pride in your national heritage, whatever that might be described as. But that is different than a nationalism in which the government authority is believed in all respects, and whatever the government wants, the government should obtain. So, a total turning over of critical thought and concern to a belief in the ruling legitimacy of the national authority of the time, coupled with a great desire to squelch whatever alternative voices or dissenting voices exist as a cultural theme. And that sort of nationalism, I think, is very dangerous because it is there's a much reduced interest in looking critically at government action when you have a wave of nationalistic mentality. And of course, what that also ties into is number 9, which is wartime mentality and permanent war economy. All of those are linked. Media is responding to the government activity, and it also feeds off this patriotism that's moving to nationalism, and together they support this wartime mentality and permanent war economy, which continues the momentum of the threat, which is reported in the media, and it becomes this cycle.
Right. Well, and let's not skip number 8, because actually I think you said before you didn't see too much of this problem here yet, but the lack of critical response from religious denominations. I noticed a lot of religious denominations came out in favor of at least the Afghanistan war, if not both of them.
Well, there were a lot of denominations that came out against both the Afghanistan war and this current Iraq war, this Operation Iraqi Freedom, and even the Pope, as the war drums were beating more loudly, kept issuing statements. Catholic bishops did, major religious denominations did. I think there was some kind of activity or response from these religious denominations, at least at the national headquarters level, critical of this, you know, movement toward with preemptive war or whatever the Bush administration was calling it. So I think we see some level of that. Now, the problem is that it hasn't filtered down to the congregational level enough so that you have a whole wellspring of critical response to governmental military activity and this whole new wave of investigation and surveillance authority that can be really identified as a religious-based and scripturally-based activist-level response. We don't see that yet. But I don't rank number 8 very high on the list of how close we are coming to a national security state because I do think these critical responses exist.
Are you worried at all that the so-called faith-based initiatives where the national government starts giving welfare checks to all these churches is going to make them more dependent on the state and less likely to come forward and speak out against war?
Yeah, and I think that's a concern. And, of course, there are people who have been raising that issue with the time that the faith-based initiative was announced, that many of these faith-based groups, the National Conference of Catholic Bishops among them, through whatever charity services they've got, like St. Vincent de Paul Society or Catholic Relief Services or, local diocese or parish operations, and the same would apply to other major Christian denominations like Lutheran, Episcopal, Methodist, and so on. A lot of them have also been politically critical of government policy in a lot of areas, including this wartime mentality and the wars in the first Iraq war, the Afghanistan war, and the current Iraq situation. So if you now get an arrangement where the government is providing large amounts of money to these religious denominations in order to assist with faith-based initiatives for the poor, you are in, I think, a potentially compromised position in terms of whether you're going to be more willing to speak out politically. So, yeah, I do think that that's a concern.
I think we mentioned a little bit about direct attack on dissent.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously the increased government surveillance of the citizenry. But
you know, right.
I noticed on the website, and honestly I haven't gotten a chance to get your book, but I found a webpage somewhere that listed the 12, and it also had 13 and 14, a couple extras on here, concerning the youth and education. I was wondering if you can touch on that at all.
Well, I'm not sure if it was my website or maybe someone else's. There's another listing of national security state characteristics, which I think goes up to 14, and they're somewhat different than these.
The one I found, I mean, it had your name on it, and it had the 12 exactly as you worded them.
Oh, I see.
So you didn't have anything about the youth and education?
I said that I think I may have mentioned in my website that if you wanted to continue with this list, other kinds of items to put on there would be how education is seen at the national state level and how youth are either educated or you might say indoctrinated into the workings of the state and are taught to be servants of the state. That's, you know, now we're getting into much more of a 1984 kind of scenario. But I think that we'd want to look at if you get much more close to a real full-blown national security state situation, you want to look at how education is being conducted. You may want to look at the merger of corporate power and government power. You see that at both ends of the political spectrum, both extreme communist states and extreme fascist states, both at the left and the right, where corporate and government power are together, and at extreme left, you have no corporate power basically at all because the state is supposed to own everything. You've got, you know, nationalization of major corporate enterprises. And on the right, you have corporate power, which is almost in tune with or almost controls the political authority, so that the political authority is in service of a new level of multinational corporate interests. Now, whether that actually has occurred at the national level here in the United States is another debate, but I wanted to not put that on the list particularly because that gets us into a whole nother analysis that's down the road of how you see this from like a socialist perspective or other kinds of economic and analytical perspectives, and it doesn't really return us to this whole political question that I wanted to raise more primarily about surveillance authorities and government power and war on terrorism with respect to what's going on in the Patriot Act, for example.
Right. Well, and actually, I mean, really, no matter what your point of view is, tyranny is always defined by the means of production and the police power being combined, like you said, if it's of the left or of the right. And really, I mean, if you think about it, it's the multinational corporations that have the databases full of all of our personal information, and then they go and make a deal and sell it all to the government.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, a big businessman, the worst thing he can do to me probably is, well, besides fire me, is maybe junk mail me to death, but he can turn over his whole file on me to the national government, and they can sure kill me if they feel like it.
Right, and then, of course, you've got ChoicePoint, and Greg Palast has been, and some other investigative reporters have been talking more about how certain corporations are with information databases to sell or working with the government to either sell or develop those. And I think you're going to see more of that in the Homeland Security Act and the Department of Homeland Security. And there's this talk of, you know, the Total Information Awareness Campaign that was supposedly a project of the Defense Department, DARPA, Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, which has been renamed to the Terrorism Awareness, Terrorism Information Awareness, rather, extent of Total Information Awareness. So the project idea hasn't been completely abandoned. So we have those problems, I think. But I would agree that that level of corporate and political cooperation and involvement has to be part of the overall debate. But I wanted to keep my list focused on these other legislative and judicial questions, you know.
Sure. Well, what about posse comitatus? That's got to be on your list, too. And the draft, that's something else. But apparently it's the Democrats, not the Republicans, who are trying to start the draft back up and are trying to take out or overturn the posse comitatus statute from 1865.
Right, 1868 or 1870, that was a statute passed during the days of Reconstruction that made it, that prohibited the use of federal military, the military arm of the government from enforcing civil law. And in fact, in the Homeland Security Act, there is a reaffirmation of the Posse Comitatus Act that the government just, you know, re-acknowledges that it's important to keep the military and civilian law enforcement operations separate. So I'm not so sure if we're going to be seeing, military, National Guard kind of activity in standard law enforcement, which obviously would be a violation of Posse Comitatus principles. I don't think that's an issue of a debate right now. I don't see anyone who's talking about overturning the Posse Comitatus statute, especially since the Homeland Security Act includes a reaffirmation of it. Now, whether the draft is ever going to be reinstituted, there's always debate in Congress. Someone is always introducing another bill to reintroduce the draft, and it gets very little support. Whether such a bill would get support now, I don't know. I don't think that there is a widespread public. I haven't seen any polling figures, but I don't think that there's any widespread public support for reinstituting the draft.
Okay, I thought that there was something coming up in Congress this week or next week about Posse Comitatus.
I'm not aware of it.
Okay, I need to look into that. That's actually a matter of hearsay. I need to double-check on that. I remember there was talk about it, looking into making some minor revisions after September 11th, but hopefully that...
There is the talk about local law enforcement being called into service to enforce immigration laws so that municipal and city police would be part of trying to look for immigrants and checking status of people that they come across and working with federal authorities in the state and justice departments and the Department of Homeland Security on immigration activity. But that's not a Posse Comitatus issue.
Okay, well, I mean, they were using the words Campbell Act and Posse Comitatus then. I'm talking like in the month right after September 11th. Now, that pressure might have died down.
I just don't think you're going to see that right now.
Okay, but then again, you know, if there's another September 11th, do you doubt that there'd be soldiers all over the street?
Oh, I don't doubt that. And, in fact, there were soldiers all over airports and all over the place originally in September 11th in the couple of months following that. One of the things that got me started on this book, as I mentioned in my introduction, was my experience at Reagan National Airport in October of 2001, when there were armed Army units patrolling the airport and walking around in squads of two throughout the terminal, which I think made everybody nervous. And you don't see that hardly as much now. But sure, if there is another major terrorist attack on U.S. soil, I think all bets are off. I mean, I think we're going to see Patriot Act 2. We're going to see new initiatives by the government. We're going to see increased surveillance. We're going to see maybe even some discussion of overturning the Posse Comitatus Act so there can be military enforcement of civil law. I think any number of changes are possible if that's the case.
Yeah, and in fact, speaking of Patriot Act 2, and we're almost out of time here, but I read something that said that the definition of a terrorist under the Patriot Act as it stands now and the definition of a terrorist under Patriot Act 2, the Domestic Security Enhancement Act of 2003, whatever they call it there, that the definition of terrorism is changing to be a looser definition in the new draft. Is that right? Do you know about that?
I don't say that the definition is looser. I think there are new definitions of who is a agent of a foreign power and who is a foreign power. There would be new definitions of that, which would increase investigation and surveillance, mostly of non-citizens in that respect. There are potential changes in the definition of what is material support for terrorism, and that could have wide-ranging effects. And there are definite changes in government surveillance and investigative powers, including not having to release information of individuals who are seized or detained or arrested on suspicion of terrorism. And in fact, there was a decision from the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals that basically said that very thing in the Freedom of Information Act lawsuit that was brought by the ACLU and several other groups about the September 11th detainees. The district court had said that those names had to be released, and then the appeal was made by the government, and then this Court of Appeals decision just came out that reversed the district court and said that those names did not have to be released, that there was an exception to the Freedom of Information Act that applied here.
Right, and so, the DOJ said that they were keeping the name secret to protect the privacy of those they had arrested, right?
Well, not only that, but they said that they needed to keep the name secret for purposes of national security. So I think we already have some aspects of Patriot Act 2 occurring.
No, judge-made law. I love it. All right, well, we're right out of time. Do you have any closing comments real quick before we let you go?
Well, I was hoping that your listeners would, you know, take some time to be aware of these concerns and, you know, consider how they can personally respond to these issues. This is going to be with us for a long time. And I encourage people to go to my website, maybe post a comment, and certainly consider getting the book. And the website is www.nogreaterthreat.com. And there's a couple of pages on the website that have author information and information on how you get the book. It's also available from Barnes & Noble on Amazon. And there's also information on the website how you can post a comment. And, you know, if you want to, people want to come and have me speak at certain events or seminars or programs, workshop sessions, I'm available to do that.
Excellent. Thank you. Chuck Michaels, the author of No Greater Threat, America After September 11th and the Rise of a National Security State. Thank you, sir, for coming on the air.
Hey, I appreciate it. Thanks a lot.